Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, you are very welcome to The Tonight Show. Simon Harris, TikTok Taoiseach or tenacious statisticians. We examine how the government agenda, cabinet and the coalition will be impacted by his leadership.
I think my job now as the new leader of Fine Gael is to meet individually with each member of the parliamentary party and really to take stock of where they're at.
Plus, the UN Security Council passes a resolution demanding a ceasefire in Gaza after the US choose to abstain rather than veto the vote.
The draft resolution has been adopted as Resolution 2728-2024.
And Vladimir Putin has acknowledged that radical Islamists were responsible for the deadliest attack in Russia in nearly two decades. It's been less than a week since Leo Varadkar's seismic resignation announcement, a move that registered shockwaves on the Irish political Richter scale. Since then, Simon Harris has taken over as the leader of Fine Gael and looks set to be elected Taoiseach when the Dáil returns on April 9th. Earlier today, he met with Leo Varadkar to discuss the transition of power and taking over the role.
Well, I don't think he'd mind me saying that he said it's important to be yourself and that every holder of office has to bring themselves and their own authenticity to the role. And I think that's good advice, which I was very grateful.
But what will Simon Harris's tenure as Taoiseach look like and what impact will it have on the coalition, cabinet and the country? Well, joining me to discuss this further is Fine Gael Minister of State, Neil Richmond, Fianna Fáil TD and European Parliament candidate, Barry Cowan, political lecturer and founder of the Ireland Thinks polling company, Kevin Cunningham, and Irish Independent political reporter, Gabia Gadafiscata. You are all very welcome to the programme. To come to you first, Gabia, I'm sure the last couple of days have been overwhelming for Simon Harris. He just had a couple of days to get his first real speech together yesterday in Athlone. But really, it will be another couple of weeks. It will be the Ardèche before he puts sort of any meat on the bones of what his real vision for Fine Gael is. But what sense did you get of him yesterday?
Yeah, so they say a week is a long time in politics, and never has that statement rung true. I mean, if you look at this time last week, I don't think Simon Harris had the faintest clue that he would be sitting a week on considering what are going to be my areas of policy's priority as Taoiseach. And I think yesterday was quite seismic for Fine Gael. We had their selection convention for Midlands North West, the European seat in Athlone, and he was also elected, of course, as leader for the party. It became very clear very quickly that he would be the leader and Taoiseach-elect, if you will. And so he really put in the effort to try and rally the troops yesterday. He spoke about going back to those core Fine Gael values, such as law and order, making work pay, putting small businesses back in focus, even having a pop at Sinn Féin and the IRA. And that's very much traditional Fine Gael style. The challenge for Simon Harris now is, and I hope that he discussed it this morning when he met still the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, was, you know, how do I keep this momentum going so that it translates into electoral success in 2 months' time when we have those, or 3 months' time when we have those elections in June, locals and Europeans, and then, of course, a general election. I think one thing that has become much clearer now from his, from Leo Varadkar's shock resignation and from Simon Harris coming in is that the coalition leaders, Eamon Ryan, Micheál Martin, they're emphasising we want the government to go to full term. And what this means now for the general election is that actually will be later. Perhaps there may have been speculation in Leinster House. Maybe we'll be looking at a summer election. Maybe we'll have a giveaway budget and then go to the country. I think now the difference is we are going to have an election early next year. Simon Harris is going to want trying to utilise every single moment when he is Taoiseach to get the support boosted for Fine Gael so that when the next general election comes around, they can, of course, they have a third of TDs not running again. They have put strong candidates on the ballot to get those candidates elected. So they have a chance of, you know, pushing Sinn Féin out of government.
And he did make that clear, Kevin, in that doorstep this evening. He said, look, it's not for the public to be switching on the television every couple of nights to try and figure out when is the next election going to be, although I'm not sure how many members of the public actually do that. But he made it clear that he wants to go full term. And I think Eamon Ryan and Micheál Martin have also suggested that. But your polling yesterday would suggest more and more people now would like a general election.
Yeah. There's a significant increase in the number of people who want a general election immediately. I think it was up 16 points. There was also an increase in the number of people who wanted the election to go to full term all the way to March. And generally speaking, those sorts of numbers are dictated by whether you support the government or support the opposition. Generally speaking, those that support the government obviously wanted to go further, and those that support the opposition wanted to happen earlier. And I think generally that's probably a function of the opposition leading in particular, Sinn Féin, trying to emphasise the extent to which they wanted that election to come earlier, and voters, I think, follow them in some respect.
Gabby, you mentioned too this idea of keeping up this momentum, and there is a lot of energy and talk, of course, around Fine Gael at the minute. There was also this moderate bounce, wasn't there, in the polls yesterday for the party. Where do those votes come from, and do you put that firmly down to the fact that there has been this new leader, and with a new leader of any party comes the bounce?
Yeah, I think it's true with any new leader, any kind of publicity of political party gets, you'll get a bounce. Now, one of the interesting things is about it was a 2% bounce. Most people would say that's generally within the margin of error. But what we're able to do is look at the types of people that actually changed. Because it's a panel, we're able to look at how people have said that they voted in previous polls to try to see, well, who are the people who are now switching from other parties to Fine Gael to try to understand, is there any sort of basis for this? And the people that switched, now it is more than 2% because some people switched out and some people switched in, but that number that is more than 2%, the vast majority of them, 80%+ actually had a very high appraisal of Simon Harris, more so than any other subset of the electorate, sort of around 80, I think it was 2%, basically said that they thought Simon Harris was going to be a very good Taoiseach in and of itself.
And they wouldn't have heard, just to be clear, this was the speech that he made yesterday. So they didn't get that first sort of big presentation for him.
This poll would have been conducted for the Sunday Independent, I should say. It was conducted on the Friday. And while it is a small sample, like this isn't a huge number of people, it does give you an interesting indication as to the types of voters that are moving around, the types of voters that he appeals to. One of the things that's interesting is he doesn't appear to be a TikTok Taoiseach. We did actually ask people whether they consume TikTok and various other social media platforms. And that particular characteristic of whether you consume TikTok or not, I think there was only one or two people who actually did consume TikTok. His voters that switched broadly seem to be coming from Fianna Fáil. A little bit from the Social Democrats is interesting, but also, broadly speaking, they're older, but more significantly more female, which is something we've seen around any polling around Simon Harris in the last couple of months.
Taking some votes from you, Barry Cowan, does that concern you?
Anyone taking votes from me concerns me. He was a TikTok minister. I don't know if he'll be a TikTok Taoiseach. But in the first instance, look, he's the appointee of the Fine Gael party, which is their right and preserve. Thankfully, they've done that quite quickly. He will now head up government. He will chair government in his first job will be to ensure that the legislative programme associated with the government's programme for government is adhered to. And that's, you know, he was given that confirmation. He has said, albeit briefly, that, he doesn't envisage an election. He wants the government to go full term. And it's business as usual for the government in that sense. You know, the personalities don't come into it when you're drawing up an agreement. And the programme for government is explicit when it says that any change of leader will be accommodated by the other parties in government, and the vote will be accordingly when he is nominated for Taoiseach. And we wish him well, and we should also remind, you know, I want to say as a Dáil colleague, I want to commend Leo Varadkar for the job that he did and the respect that he showed to the office of Taoiseach. And I'm conscious especially of the role he played during Brexit, the manner in which he calmed and reassured the nation at a vital time, and that government and the subsequent one assisted and helped employees and business be in a position to survive, and also in relation to Brexit and the retention of the Good Friday Agreement and the sacrosanct nature of it and the way in which he sought and got support from Europe to ensure that it was adhered to. and it was the mechanism and the vehicle by which other agreements flowed.
But as he sort of laid out, I suppose, what his vision is for Fine Gael, what his priorities were, do you think all of those are completely aligned with what was agreed with the programme for governance?
No, look, I mean, he is obviously entitled, as he sees fit, to improve the fortunes of his own party, and he will do that, as we will and other parties will. You know, when this government comes to a conclusion, people will adjudicate on its performance, will adjudicate on those within it, and how they lived up to the commitments that they made. But they will also look at and analyse and scrutinise what policies, what proposals are emanating from their respective manifestos, where all of us will seek to win more support and be in a stronger position in government in order to do many of the things that we weren't in a position to do or agree with our partners because we didn't have the wherewithal and the numbers to do so. When the government was formed, but ultimately a government had to be formed. Ultimately, stability is very important to the success of this country, especially considering the amount of outward and foreign direct investment we have, which has yielded record levels of employment, which record low levels of unemployment, record receipts, record exports, and that predicates everything else that you do within the public service. And all parties within the government have respective roles, respective responsibilities in various departments. Fine Gael have it in relation to justice, in relation to enterprise and others. And the Taoiseach now, or the Taoiseach elect, will either move people into those positions. But ultimately, as I said, the programme is the programme for government.
And if he starts to stray away from those,
well, if he starts to stray away from those and goes on a solo run, well, he'll be reined in pretty quick, or else Sinn Féin will get their wish, and they will get their election.
Is scrapping the hate speech legislation, as some of your colleagues have called for, is that doing a solo run, or would you be in favour of that?
I don't think it took a change of leader in Fine Gael for that to be questioned in the manner in which it is by various parties. And I've heard Neil say, over the airwaves in the last number of days, that it is being looked at again by the minister. The minister has a responsibility to make amendments, to make changes and bring it back. And we'll have a look at it then. But in its present form, there is far too much a grievance with it for it to proceed as it stands presently. Anyway.
Yeah, he did say when he was asked about that hate speech legislation that we need to approach these issues with humility, was the phrase. What does he mean by that?
Well, I think we all, the referenda that we had a couple of weeks ago was the first time we faced the people in about 4 years. And we have to be sure that when we approach them again, be they electorally or just in terms of policy, that we are clear that we are listening, that we are demonstrating that we're listening. And the incitement against hatred is just one piece of legislation in the door where people have concerns and want to have a further discussion. It's been taken back by Minister McEntee, as Barry rightly says. There's been amendments from people who think it go too far and people who think it doesn't go far enough. And Patrick Costello from the Green Party said as much this morning on radio. So she has a responsibility and has undertaken that responsibility to give it a good look, to look at the referendums, to see where it can be improved. And I just
Has the referendum unnerved you about proceeding with legislation when so many people do appear to be against it?
I think it started before the referendum, but I think we'd be foolish to say that the referendum campaign didn't impact all political parties. Remember, all political parties, bar one, campaigned for this, and we all have
to... So is it long-fingered, do you think? Realistically, because that is the sense now that the government did get a bloody nose, and you can talk about the opposition parties, but they're not in charge of legislation. They did get a bloody nose over the referendum, and they're not going to touch something like the hate speech legislation 12 months out from an election, given the fact that it is unpopular.
No, there's a process in place to review the legislation. That has already been there. There's an awful lot of amendments to go through. And I think one thing that is quite clear, and Barry is right to say it, we have agreed a programme for government. He was one of the people that negotiated. We fully intend to stick to the programme for government and absolutely to ensure that that which is contained in the programme for government that can be achieved before the general election is achieved.
But do you think, just to be clear, sorry to cut across you, Neil, do you think that hate speech legislation, you're talking about all the works and all the referendums and it's back in Helen McEntee's office now and she mightn't even be the Justice Minister in a couple of weeks, we'll go to that. Do you think that that will become legislation before the next election?
I think there's a possibility, but realistically, I think that there is a review process underway. There's an awful lot of amendments reviewed. There's an awful lot of people from both people who are in favour of it and both people who are against it who want that to be reflected upon.
I think what you're saying, but not explicitly there, the hate speech legislation is gone, isn't it?
I think in its current format, it would be very hard to see that progress through the door. But I think we are going back to reflect it, as Barry and others in his party have asked.
Barry, you're laughing.
I'm thinking of going, gone. It might well be going. Look, in its present form, it's going nowhere.
Okay. How will that
complacency was the problem with the referendum, the same issue.
I'm not really sure what the present form of it means. I mean, what is it that you're looking to change about it, or what is it that the minister is going to change about it? Mm. Also, like, the hate speech legislation is just one part of a whole swathe of laws that have not yet to be passed by the Justice Minister, including licensing laws, for example, that we know as well some of our colleagues now no longer want. They think it's too much on the left side and they want that pulled back. So if you look at how damaging the referendums were, and I do think it is important to make this point, because Minister Neil Richmond sat here before Christmas and the comments that he made about immigration were utilised by the no side, very much so in the lead up to the referendum campaigns. I think your quotes were actually put on posters that were circulated by the vote no side. So the government, and I think Simon Harris now, would do well to steer well clear away from all that. If they are bringing it back to basics, if they're bringing it back to Gardaí, to law and order, if they're cutting tax, for example, you know, education, childcare, these issues that Ireland can understand, and really where they need investment and they need political focus, then that's where they should stick to.
Yeah, and you picked up on that yesterday, Kevin, didn't you, that this sort of repeated message, we're going back to core values, from Fine Gael, what that was actually signalling?
Yeah, in some way, I mean, I thought it was interesting to focus on law and order, to focus on core values, the kind of, in some sense, a minimisation of the ambition to some extent of Fine Gael, I guess. You could argue that when Fine Gael was perhaps a 30% party, that they were looking at becoming this kind of catch-all party, the type of political party that Fianna Fáil had been for the vast majority of the history of the state, where they were up around 40%, where they had to appeal to a broad base of support, where they had to focus on big and broad issues. I mean, the two biggest issues, three biggest issues are probably housing, healthcare and immigration. And clearly those, housing and healthcare, weren't really mentioned in Simon Harris's speech, which to me, to some extent, suggests that, I guess, obviously speaking to the Fine Gael party, so that's obviously a base. But broadly speaking, if you're speaking to the Fine Gael party and thinking about broadening its appeal, you'd assume that those other issues might actually come to the fore when you're trying to win a broad amount of support. If the Fine Gael party is only interested in a kind of a core strategy, then it is kind of aiming towards that 25%, I guess, in some respect.
Is that where your aim is now then, Neil? Sort of an acknowledgement the days of being this catch-all party is gone. I mean, you had your own colleague Michael Ring saying yesterday the party has gone too far left for too long and it's time to come back to the middle, if not move a bit closer to the right again. An acknowledgement, as Kevin says, that the party now needs to focus on this base, even if that base is around 20-25%.
I think all parties that have been in government for 13 years, as Fine Gael has, and been in government as part of coalitions, have to try hard to make sure what they stand for, what their core values are, comes out in the performance of government. And what Simon said in his speech yesterday, which is the first of a series of speeches, there'll be a lot more detailed speech, really important one on European affairs this evening, for example, where we're going to focus on where exactly we think we can improve in the ministries that Fine Gael ministers hold currently, and all within the programme for government. We have very clear aims, absolutely, to back small business, to improve law and order in terms of public policing, but also to really develop that idea. And this is something that's very personal to Simon, that idea of equality of opportunity, the sort of work he did in furthering higher education. And personally, I think that is something that can appeal to everyone, regardless of where they see themselves on the political spectrum or what part of the country they live in.
So do you agree with your colleague Michael Ring or not? Did you shift too far to the left for too long?
I think we certainly went quite broad. We covered all areas, and particularly when you think of a period when we were in a confidence and supply arrangement where we covered all departments and had to do all things to all people. And obviously we've had different coalition partners over the last 13 years. And I think what the members of Fine Gael want, and we're talking about the members of Fine Gael this week, we'll talk more broadly about the Irish public at large next week and in 2 weeks when Simon becomes Taoiseach, hopefully, is we want to remind people that when you vote Fine Gael into government, and will be a coalition government, these are the areas we'll prioritise. But we will work with good parties, like-minded parties, like Barry's, like the Greens, in order to develop, deliver for overall.
So you're going to be a centre-right party again?
Well, we are a party of the Progressive Centre. We're part of the European People's Party. I wrote my thesis on Christian democracy. That's no surprise to anyone.
OK. One of your colleagues, John McGuinness, was actually on with Claire Byrne on the radio this morning, and he said, you're going to be asked to endorse now a second Fine Gael Taoiseach. That wasn't something you envisaged, and there should be a quid pro quo here. Fine Gael should be getting something in return for this. Should you?
No, I'll tell you know, you do a deal, you stick to it. You walk away from a deal. If you don't honour your commitments, your trust is questionable. Your ability to deal with others thereafter is questionable. It was plainly written into this agreement that in the event of a leader vacating that the other parties would support their respective nominee. We will do that. Nothing changes. The government continues its work. Fine Gael will have its conversation about what its core values are, what it wants to do, what it wants to prioritise. But it'll be for the electorate to decide on that when they put their manifesto before the people, as we will. We'll seek to be distinctive from our partners in government too. And ultimately, the people will decide and throw a result at us. And it's up to the elected members within the Dáil to come together and form a government thereafter, as is always the case.
Do you feel
but look, you do a deal, you stick to it. Fine Gael are re-electing, you know, they've put Simon Harris in charge. He'll be nominated. He'll be the Taoiseach. The government gets on with its business. The government has, as I said, 38 different pieces of legislation committed to by the summer. And it's Simon Harris's job to ensure that the government is cohesive and can deliver upon those
commitments. OK, very quickly, promotions and, I suppose, demotions here. Who's in the frame, Gabia?
Yes, of course, it's all speculation at this stage within the parliamentary party. But of course, tongues are wagging as they normally are, because, yes, people are expecting a cabinet reshuffle. So certainly before the weekend, we saw Enterprise Minister Simon Coveney very much so at risk from being totally removed from cabinet. However, in Athlone on Sunday, you know, it was very visible that he was much more energised. He had a bit of a spring in his step. I think he was very much so fighting to keep that cabinet position. Peter Burke, Jennifer Carr McNeill, they're currently junior ministers. They're maybe hoping to see a promotion come out of it as a result. You're alluding there as well. Helen McEntee may be moved from the Department of Justice. She may perhaps be put into Enterprise. It's not very clear who will go into her department just yet. Also, if Simon Harris is successful in unretiring some of those TDs who have said that they might not run again, Brendan Griffin, for example, is one name. You know, he may be given the position of Chief Whip and sitting in Cabinet.
And so, he did say he would consider that if something was, if a ministerialship was...
Well, I think it would be really quite a feat for Simon Harris to pull off, you know, the rabbit out of the political hat and bring back TDs who've already told their constituents and have already told their party, I'm not running again.
OK, Neil Richmond, are you disappointed? Do you think you might be up for promotion? Because your name was mentioned too, wasn't it?
I'm sure it was, but, you know, Simon will make those decisions, not Gabby. So we'll see what happens in 2 weeks' time.
Do you have a certain sympathy for Helen McEntee in that her name is the name that's been put forward as the person most likely to be moved out of her ministerialship?
I think it's greatly unfair, because I think of the achievements Helen has had in justice, particularly in terms of the agenda of domestic-based violence. Helen has been a real trailblazer in that. She's been a great minister. I worked really closely with her on Brexit when she was European Affairs Minister. She's a brilliant cabinet minister, and I think everyone respects that and acknowledges that in Fine Gael.
Well, maybe everybody, but perhaps Simon Harris won't acknowledge it.
Oh, I'd imagine Simon absolutely will value Helen's continuing contribution to cabinet. But again, these are decisions that he'll make in 2 weeks' time, and they're his decisions and his decisions alone.
There was a quote, I think it was in the Sunday Times yesterday, a Fine Gael minister quoted as saying, basically, when it comes to promotions, our colleagues with posh voices are not necessarily what people want. Who was that being directed at, do you think?
Couldn't possibly tell you.
Man from Mullingar.
No. Well, look, I don't know.
Does that mean basically no Dublin TDs up for promotion? Is that the message here? That Fine Gael needs to look at that rural vote again?
We need to look at the policies. We need to look at the values. Simon will decide the personalities and individuals. And if anyone is lucky enough to be called up to serve, and I'm very lucky in the position I have at the moment, then they do their best job regardless of what their accent is or where they come from.
OK, Barry, who would you like to see get a promotion? Do you have an opinion?
I have no opinion.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You know, whatsoever, that's the job of the Taoiseach, and the quicker he does it, the better, and we can talk about different things in this programme that are more impactful on people's lives.
Do you have any sense of jealousy at all when you see the sort of energy now that's around Fine Gael because they've got this new bounce from their new leader?
I hope to get longer ahead than I did anyway, for a start. But no, listen, that's a matter for the Taoiseach. As I said, it'll be done as soon as the Dáil comes back. And we quickly get down to business, as I said, and re-engage with the electorate in order to ensure that they see that work is being done and can be done and that it'll be an effective government for the remainder of its term.
All right, look, we're going to have to leave that conversation there for now. My thanks to Kevin Cunningham for joining us. After the break, we ask, what effect a UN Security Council resolution demanding a ceasefire in Gaza will have, and what does it say about the relationship between Israel now and the United States? Do join us. Very welcome back. Well, for the first time, the UN Security Council has called for a ceasefire in Gaza after the US chose to abstain rather than veto the vote. In response, Israel has cancelled a planned visit to the White House by its delegates. This all comes as the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, claims that Israel has blocked it from delivering aid to northern Gaza. Well, Fine Gael's Neil Richmond, Fianna Fáil's Barry Cowan and the Irish Independent's Gabia Gadafiscata have stayed with me and they're joined now by former TROCRA Director and Chair of SADACA, the Ireland-Palestine Alliance, Eamon Meehan. Eamon, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara.
I just want to go to Gabia first because this resolution from the UN Security Council has been seen as a breakthrough. The US deciding to abstain rather than to veto it. That is significant. Why did they do that? What's their reasoning?
Yes, so the White House explaining its decision today, saying that because the text did not include a strong condemnation of Hamas, they were saying we couldn't support it, but it does make some remarks about the ceasefire, of course, calling for a full ceasefire, and they're saying that's why we abstained from it. But they're saying this does not signal a shift in policy. That's not really the way it's being viewed on the international stage, especially Israel now cancelling that meeting to the White House, which really, I think, may come back to bite them because, of course, the US has been such a strong partner for them throughout the start of the war and in many ways has been funding the war in Gaza. You know, we have seen Benjamin Netanyahu being criticised by the US in recent weeks and months. And in fairness, like, Ireland did call for a ceasefire. I think it was one of the first countries to pass a vote in its parliament calling for one. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, Tánaiste Micheál Martin over in the US lobbying White House politicians, making the same urge again. And the US appears to have followed behind it and the EU as well. So Ireland has led the way in those calls for a ceasefire. So the Israel now saying we're actually going to... they've obviously been very hurt by the US's actions on this, how they did not, completely block the vote in the Security Council. Like, that leaves them very, very isolated. Their argument is, we're fighting Hamas, we're fighting all of the terrorists, and here you are not supporting us. Of course, Ireland doesn't agree with that position, and it's very hard to keep, you know, Israel, to make Israel see the Irish position and to keep emphasising the Irish position, I think, from the very start of the war. But in fairness, we are now seeing superpowers follow in the Irish position.
Yeah, and yet it was interesting, Eamon, I was watching John Kirby, one of the White House spokespersons, speaking to reporters there at the White House when he was being asked whether or not this was a major shift in position for the United States, and he denied it. He said, look, this isn't even a binding, you know, resolution. He seemed to be saying it will have no huge impact and it doesn't represent this change in our policy. Do you think it does?
It clearly does. They abstained and allowed the resolution to pass, which I think is a very clear change in policy from previous resolutions, which they voted down. I think they're trying to have it both ways, though. UN Security Council resolutions are legally binding. And the United States is already saying, well, of course, it's not legally binding. It is. And it is the responsibility of the Security Council, the permanent members in particular, but all UN members, to ensure that this resolution actually is binding and that it is enforced. Because the situation on the ground in Gaza is absolutely catastrophic. It is even worse than what we know, what we hear. there are at least 40,000 dead. The figure is 32,000, but there's at least 8,000 people who have disappeared, probably under the rubble. And I really think that unless this resolution is supported and enforced, that there is going to be a huge catastrophe, because starvation and hunger is the next thing facing everybody in Gaza.
The resolution did call for this expansion of the flow of aid into the Gaza, particularly, I suppose, northern Gaza. I understand that no aid has got into that area in the last couple of days at all. Do you have any confidence, though, if the US is saying, look, this is a non-binding resolution, it really is meaningless almost, that that changes the position of aid getting into Gaza?
I don't see how that's going to be the case unless Israel changes its position. The Egyptian authorities tell us there are 7,000 trucks lined up at the Rafah crossing, ready to go in to Gaza. But the trickle of aid in, the trickle of trucks that the Israelis are allowing in, is essentially causing starvation in Gaza. The IPC is a technical agency which does a huge amount of research on food security, and it announces famines, and it is used by the UN agencies around the world. And they said last week that 210,000 people in Gaza are literally in a famine situation. Those people are dying of starvation at the moment. Another million people are at the next level down, which is an emergency. Those people need food immediately. And I really don't see that the Israelis, from everything they've said, from all of their actions, they are not... This is a deliberate famine, and these people are being deliberately starved of the means of life, food and water.
You think they're deliberately starving, particularly those who are in northern Gaza, because they're trying to claim that territory? That's your belief?
They absolutely want... There are something between 300,000 and 400,000 Gazans still in the north of Gaza, in and around what used to be Gaza City before it was completely destroyed. And Israel's strategy, I believe, is to get those people to leave that area and to move south. And then they will either use that as a buffer, or they will adopt the strategy that they have used for decades in the West Bank, allowing settlers in, and once they find them in there, instead of removing them, they put a security cordon around them, and then the settlements will expand. That has been the strategy of Israel for 75 years, and I don't see it being any different here.
Okay. Sorry to cut across you, but I just want to put this to Neil Richmond, because Eamon was also writing today in the Irish Times and said that Ireland needs to take a stand independent of Europe, either through sanctions or other means, because we know there is this difficulty in getting Europe to take perhaps more definitive action against Israel. Do you think Simon Harris would be open to that?
I think what Simon said yesterday is that Ireland continues to stand with the Palestinian people, that we acknowledge what is going on in the Middle East at the moment is an absolute catastrophe. And I think Ireland has already taken a stand relatively independent of the rest of Europe. We saw last Friday the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, succeed in getting a number of EU member states to sign a joint letter working towards that two-state solution. Ireland was one of the first, if not the first, EU member state to call for an immediate ceasefire, to call for immediate humanitarian aid. When other EU member states cut funding to UNRWA, we increased it by 20 million
euros. So if we've led the way in the past, why not do it again? Because we perhaps have shown that if Ireland takes a position, a very strong position, that others might follow, that they do actually follow suit.
Well, absolutely. But the way you lead within the European Union, and Barry will see this up front in a couple of months' time, is you lead by building consensus, building partnerships. That's what we've done at a European Union level. We've had some success there. But don't get me wrong, the success is limited. We need to see an immediate cessation of violence, an immediate access of aid. And I think what Ireland can do within the European Union, you don't just declare sanctions independently. You can't do that in the European Union. It doesn't work like that. Trade is an overall union competence. We have to build a coalition together with other member states to keep the pressure going on. And I think we have had some progress in this, but I'm not going to pretend for an instance it's enough.
Barry Cowan, you're running for Europe. If you got in there, would you be encouraging Ireland to put on more pressure to take this independent stance and perhaps introduce trade sanctions with Israel?
I think we have been a force, despite our size, but knowing and having experience of conflict resolution and the way in which diplomacy moves to bring people together. And we've seen today, as a result of pressure that has been exerted by us and others in recent weeks and months, eventually the US not vetoing this proposal today. And as Michael said, if it's legally binding, well, then those permanent members and others have an obligation to enforce it. If the US is quick out of the traps to give the impression that it's not, well, then the rest of the international community must remind them, and the European Union must be to the forefront in its efforts to ensure that this is enforced, because this wasn't set up or provided for in the legislation of the UN to be treated in such a way. And it's a very serious matter, and it's legally binding. And it's incumbent, I believe, on our government to work, as Neil has said, to ensure that Europe agrees with the resolution, ensures that Europe acknowledges that it's legally binding, ensures that Europe insists that the US, as well as everybody else, adheres to that and works it, and makes sure, you know, to think that there's aid not getting in, to think that there's food not getting in, to hear somebody of such expertise and knowledge in this area to say that this has been used almost as a weapon of war by Israel presently, and it's absurd.
Okay, but didn't Barry Brown, didn't Fianna Fáil support the Occupied Territories Bill here in Ireland? You did, your party did support the idea of acting unilaterally at one point when you were in opposition.
Yes.
And, so what's changed?
And what has changed now is that there isn't universal support for that within Europe at the time at which you want to go it alone. So the onus and duty and responsibility and obligation of the government is to ensure that it can build alliances, that it can bring Europe together as one in a similar fashion as it has done in recent times in relation to COVID, in relation to the cost of living, and in relation to this issue too. It's imperative that Europe is unified, that Europe works towards a two-state solution.
But we have been willing. That's the point Neil made, and that's the point I think that Eamon made. Ireland has been willing in the past to be the outlier, to be the front runner when
instance,
it came to Europe. And Fianna Fáil did support the Occupied Territories Bill. And now you're saying, no, we need to wait and bring
the main,
Europe with us?
In the main, you know, we have sought for and worked within the diplomatic channels to ensure that we've got to where we are today, and have played a part in doing that. And only in recent weeks, the Taoiseach and others, you know, met with the US president and its officials to impress that upon them. And we've seen progress.
Okay.
But now there's a responsibility on the international players to ensure that the legally binding agreement that was passed today is enforced.
OK, Eamon, to the sort of the point that you were making today in the Irish Times was Ireland should act unilaterally here, take a stand. Trade sanctions, for example. I think there's nearly 5 billion of trade between Ireland and Israel. Neil's saying, look, trade rules are really an issue for Europe at large, not for a single member state to take.
Yeah. Well, of course, the Attorney General's argument on the Occupied Territories Bill was that trade is an EU competence. Mm. That is no longer a defensible position for a couple of reasons. The first is the International Court of Justice orders against Israel on the 26th of January basically said that there is a risk of genocide. The ICJ ruling from a previous case in Bosnia in 2007 said that any country, when they become aware of the risk of a genocide, must take whatever action is open to them and available to them, including all measures, and that includes trade. So
there can be an exception, and we're in exceptional times.
It's even more than that. The Genocide Convention literally is part of the EU legal order, and because of that, it takes precedence over EU law, and that means trade as well. So Ireland is totally free to make its own decisions, its own judgments, and to act on what the people want. You had Kevin Cunningham here a few minutes ago. Kevin and Ireland Thinks, on behalf of Sadaka, at the end of January, did a piece of research. 71% of the Irish people believe that it is time to sanction Israel.
OK, Neil?
There is what can be done legally and what can be done practically, and doing...
But would you agree with Eamon, there is nothing legally to prevent us from doing this?
I wouldn't necessarily, and I don't want to argue a point of law. And this is a concern. I'm not disagreeing with the point you're making. I'm just disagreeing in relation to the legalities. And I believe that ICJ case, for a start, is being appealed. But secondly, when it comes to EU trade law and the competences thereof, working unilaterally does not work. You simply cannot do that. You can say that Ireland trades X amount with Israel, but it's what the common market trades with Israel, and goods that come into Germany or Czechia from Israel,
I think
therefore then...
about 46 billion, am I right, between the EU and Israel, and Ireland is about 4.5 billion of that.
So yeah,
it's
but
not insignificant amount.
It's not insignificant, but it comes into what secondary goods, and some of them are components, say, for Apple iPhones, things like that. And it's why one of the difficulties I would have had with the Occupied Territories Bill is how do you split that out? There is absolutely a moral imperative, and I don't dispute that for a second, but there is a legal and a political way you do this through the European Union. And the best way for Ireland to act is not unilaterally. Okay. It is to work to bring the world's most largest economic bloc together on this issue in order to pressurise Israel to cease the violence, allow humanitarian aid in and build
just
towards the
just very briefly.
Just make the point very quickly that the Taoiseach and the US President Joe Biden did speak by telephone today. We're not quite sure. I've read that right out from the White House, but we're not quite sure if the resolution came up at all in the conversation. But
I think we were told it was sort of a congratulations on your retirement,
more or less. Yeah, on your resignation, I should say. I was in Brussels last week for European Council, and of course that news of the Taoiseach's resignation broke throughout all of the leaders over there, and they were very much so shocked and they couldn't believe it. Simon Harris does not have previous foreign affairs or international sort of negotiation experience. That won't be held against him. I think Ursula von der Leyen didn't have any experience either when she first came into the role. But, I mean, he's going to have to seriously push the Irish position now. And if he's going to have to lead the way, that'll be yet another challenge for him.
All right, look, we're going to have to leave that conversation there for now. My thanks to Neil Richmond, to Barry Cowan, to Gabby Agatovskaya and to Eamon Meehan for coming at us. Coming up, it's been called the most deadly attack on Russian soil in 20 years. We bring you the very latest on that Moscow concert hall shooting. Do stay with us. Russia has charged 4 men for attacking a Moscow concert hall in which at least 137 people were killed. Earlier today, Russian President Vladimir Putin acknowledged the gunmen who carried out the attack were Islamic extremists. Russian officials have also claimed there was Ukrainian involvement, though Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky staunchly rejects this. Well, joining me to discuss this further is Professor of Politics at the School of Law and Government at Dublin City University, Donika O'Bacon. Donika, lovely to have you on the programme as always. How significant do you think it was that Vladimir Putin did now acknowledge that it was Islamists, extremists who were responsible for this attack, given the fact that he was pushing this narrative since the attack happened, that this was somehow Ukraine's responsibility?
Well, he's still pushing the narrative that Ukraine is in some way responsible. I mean, he spoke on television again today, and, you know, it was really full of innuendo. I mean, his point was, who benefits from this destabilization of Russia? And, you know, he mentioned the Kyiv regime, as he calls it, the Nazis. These are the people, he said, who benefits, and their Western masters. So they're not irreconcilable, saying that Islamists were, you know, maybe the ones who carried out the attacks. And of course, as you say, 4 men have been, taken into custody. 4 men from Tajikistan, which is a Central Asian republic where I've done considerable research over the years. And there was clear signs of torture on those men as they were in court today. It's going to have huge implications, of course, for the very large Tajik population in Russia. So, you know, the imperative to blame Ukraine is still there, and he will try and weave this into the narrative, because the alternative is to admit that there was a huge security failure in Russia, which has caused the biggest loss of life from a terrorist incident in 20 years.
Are people asking within Russia why it is that he has focused so much of his time and energy on Ukraine when one of the greatest threats was within his own country, and that threat was brought to his attention a number of weeks ago by the US?
That's very true. The US warned not only that there would be an attack of this nature, but even from where it would come. It's quite clear that the FSB and, of course, Putin's regime generally have focused on Ukraine, and they have focused on suppressing domestic dissent. Somebody who was actually at the concert on Friday was saying that they were at Navalny's funeral and there was like one policeman for every person who was attending the funeral. But at that concert, there was virtually no security presence. So they have, by virtue of the fact of perhaps aiming at the wrong enemies, left themselves open to this, vulnerability, which has been exploited now by Islamic extremists.
Will Putin use this attack to perhaps push through more extreme sanctions, more extreme measures against Russia, to perhaps even centralise more power around the Kremlin? Because that's what he's done in the past, isn't it?
That's right. And one Russian newspaper said that usually when you had these kinds of terror attacks, because this is not the first time, they have occurred in the past. And every time Putin has tried to harness these attacks, you know, to benefit his own grasp on power. But as the newspaper said today, you know, it's not quite clear what screws there are left to tighten in Russia. You know, virtually all power is now under the authority of Putin. So, you know, but he certainly will use this. This is the form of the past. But as I said, I think it will also be used to, you know, press down on the Tajik population, who are a very vulnerable group, who do all the work that nobody in Russia wants to do, who have a visa-free regime and usually travel freely and live amongst Russians, but have been, you know, racially discriminated against in the past. And it's only going to be much more difficult for them now as a result of this attack.
Was the intelligence on this attack missed or ignored because intelligence... and because Putin is now so focused and distracted by that war in Ukraine?
Absolutely, it has to be a contributory factor. And let's not forget that, I mean, you know, as we talk about this attack in Moscow, Russia is, you know, sending missiles every hour into Ukraine, into Kyiv, into Lviv, into Odessa. And that was indeed the focus of President Volodymyr Zelensky's address to his people today, that Putin is describing everybody a terrorist except himself as he commits terrorism on a daily basis.
France, off the back of this attack, has raised its own terror level, I believe, to the very highest level. What threat, I suppose, does this group, this ISIS-K, present to Russia, to France and to other countries at this point?
It raises a serious threat. I mean, France has raised this level now to the highest possible, which means that they consider an attack to be imminent. I mean, Russia was attacked for a combination of ideological reasons and geopolitical reasons. But, you know, the target base of ISIS and this particular branch of ISIS is worldwide. I mean, they have a very wide range of targets, which include other Islamic regimes that they disagree with, be they in Iran, where 100 people were killed in a bombing in January, or in Afghanistan, where the same group that bombed Moscow bombed the airport in 2021 and indeed bombed the Russian embassy in 2022. So their targets are global. On this occasion, it was Russia, but it could be France, it could be the United Kingdom, it could be the United States.
OK, we have to leave it there. Donika, thank you for your time as always. Well, that's it from us on The Tonight Show this evening. From all of the late team here, good night to you all and do take care.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.